on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there, welcome aboard. The trout streams have been open for a couple of weeks now in New South Wales. The high country is starting to thaw out a bit and Peachy has been up to Eucombeen. He's been all around checking out the trout streams up and down the Great Divide. We'll check out Peachy's Grapevine for our first cast of The Big Fish to find out how it's looking for the upcoming season if you're looking to get away and hit some of the sweet water this summer. It's all coming up on The Big Fish. It's the big fish and the trout season for the streams in New South Wales opened on the October long weekend. Peachy was there to give us an overview of how it's going. Let's talk to the man himself. Good morning.
G'day, Scott. How are you?
Yeah, going really well. You've been listening to the grapevine for us. You've been checking out your contacts near and wide from the New England tablelands down to the Victorian border, right along that great dividing range. I think a lot of people wouldn't realise how much fly fishing for trout we have. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Every stream that springs up around 1,000 metres, you know, holds fish pretty much going east or west of the divide. What are you hearing?
Yeah, so there are a few fish around. I think what we're seeing, what I'm hearing at the moment is we've pretty much got a continuation of last season, which is there's some decent browns around and people are catching reasonable numbers of browns, but the rainbows seem to be very much depleted on previous years. A lot of people are speculating that's the cormorants.
But they rely more on stocking, don't they? I mean, you see that up on the New England, that the hatchery keeps them going, but they're now putting browns into some of those high growth rate streams as well, and they're reaching mammoth proportions and they're pretty self-sustaining, aren't they?
That's right. Yeah, I personally think browns are much better suited to most of the Australian rivers, just because they're a bit more tolerant of sort of warmer, slower water than the rainbows are. So yeah, I think the browns probably tend to spawn naturally a little bit easier than the rainbows do. But what I'm hearing is that the hatchery down in Thredbo actually had a lot of trouble getting rainbows this season. I believe they only had 40 brood stock. And most of those weren't even in the traps, so they had to go out on the lake and try to catch them to get some broodstock. And certainly what I'm hearing from Eucombeen and those kinds of surrounds is there's low numbers of rainbows. We had a competition there last weekend on the lake, and it was very difficult for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of being gale force winds, but there were very, very low numbers of fish caught, and of those that were caught, a good proportion of them were browns instead of rainbows, which is pretty unusual for Lake Eucombeen.
Steve, was that a lock-style fly fishing event?
It was, yes. It was one of the New South Wales rounds for Fly Fish Australia, but we had 20 anglers this time, and there were only 28 fish caught for the competition. And, you know, in previous years, last season we were sort of getting between 1 and 200 for a comp. And in previous years, we've had as many as 750 for a comp. So definitely the numbers are down, and it seems to be the rainbows that are primarily affected.
Well, not only are they easier to fool, but they come up more consistently in the bag numbers, don't they? Whereas there are lots of browns, but they're down deep on the Yabby bed sometimes or mooching around somewhere. I don't know. You know, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, is it the fact that there are probably a lot of brown trout, but the rainbows are easier to catch?
Well, I think so. The rainbows definitely have more of a tendency to school up. And are a little bit more predictable in their behaviour, whereas the browns tend to be more solitary, I think, and they can be anywhere. As you said, they can be up on the edges around sort of rocky points and timber and places like that. But they can also be out deep. I caught the browns that I caught in this comp were out in 14 or 15 foot of water. So, and, you know, near the bottom. So it does make it a little more tricky to target them, I would say. But having said that, you know, they're great quality fish. When you do catch a brown, they're tending to be pretty good ones, which is nice.
And what techniques were you using?
Yeah, so I saw a couple of people in my boat caught browns up on the edges, just sort of pulling flies on sinking lines. I was fishing on the outside because of the direction of the wind, so I was fishing deep under an indicator, or what we call a bung fly, which is basically an indicator on a hook that we use in comp fishing.
There's a Pommies call it fishing the bung.
Yes.
And it's a reservoir technique that's been perfected by the English, the bung, isn't it? And what is it meant to be?
Well, it's primarily just to comply with competition rules, right? Because we're not allowed to fish a separate indicator on the line. So it has to be on a hook, and it counts as one of our flies in our maximum fly count that we're allowed to fish. So it's basically just an indicator on a hook.
Right. And so were you fishing... So you're fishing on the surface, though. You weren't using sinking lines or anything like that to try to get down to them?
No. We were using sinking flies. So what you'll tend to do is fish weighted nymphs under an indicator. So you're fishing at a quite specific depth and trying to suspend your flies basically at that depth. And then the action of the waves on the bung on the surface causes the flies to jiggle up and down in the column underneath, which the trout seem to like.
And there's nothing to this bung fly, is it? It's just a blob, basically.
Well, there are a couple of different designs that you can use. I mean, they have to be, for us, they have to be competition legal. And that means now that we're not allowed to use foam anymore. So we sort of have various designs that we incorporate. And the other thing that you want a bung fly to do is to tell you when your flies have reached depth. So the flies that we use now, they tend to lay down, and then when your flies get down to depth, they stand up so that you know that you're fishing in deep enough water.
Gotcha. Right. And you're not allowed to use foam anymore.
No. It's part of the evolution of competition.
Who makes
fishing.
Up these rules?
The Europeans primarily.
Yeah. I love it. I love it when they ban a fly because it's too deadly. That's the sure way to make people fish with it. Say, oh, this fly's banned.
That's right.
Yeah. It's the Big Fish, and we're speaking with Steve Peachy on the season launch. So he's at a lock-style fly fishing event down on Eucombeen. So where have all the rainbows gone, Steve? What are some of the theories about that great rainbow fishery, because they run later in the year. They run up to spawn up the Eucombeen River in early spring or you know, from midwinter onwards, sort of thing.
Yeah, so it's the leading theory. Look, I mean, I have my ideas about what has happened, and it's there's a certain amount of speculation involved, of course, but I believe that a large number of them have actually been eaten by the cormorants last season. I started noticing towards the second half of last season, in about November, I fished my way back from the sort of the upper Mitimita in northeast Victoria and up through the Snowy Mountains and through a whole bunch of those rivers. And I found quite patchy results. Some rivers seemed to be completely barren and others were still fishing okay. But the thing that really stuck out to me was keeping track of the fish that I caught. Over a two-week period there, I caught 60 browns and only 3 rainbows, which was shockingly out of proportion. It would normally be something like the other way around in most normal seasons. So it was pretty clear to me back then that something was going on with the rainbows. But this year, this season so far, it seems to be kind of a continuation of that. There are a couple of things going on at Eucombeen, I think. Having spoken to some people who were fishing the river above the lake at the same time as we were fishing the lake, they weren't doing any good either. They were reporting no, you know, very low to no numbers of fish in the Yukamine River or the top of the lake. So my personal theory is that a good proportion of them have been eaten. Those that haven't, I think, have probably learned to stay well out of the way in daylight hours and are probably lurking in the depths of the lake during the day and perhaps coming up on the edges only to feed at night. But, you know, there are other rivers and other places where the fishing has been a little better. So it seems to be quite patchy. There seems to be certain waterways that have been very heavily affected and others that are still fishing sort of reasonably.
And the Tasmanians have been whinging long and hard about the cormorant invasion as well, blaming the mainlanders for shooing them down their way. There's the same theories down there. It's the Big Fish with Steve Peachy, who's been fishing on Yukambeen out of the boat. It's interesting, but Steve Dunn, who's a regular from out of Midderby, shared some great stories last season, last summer, when the cicadas and the grasshoppers were really on, and some beautiful Tasmanian style or New Zealand style sight fishing along the edges of Yukambeen for big brown trout. They were really in feeding up, and great sport. Mm. And similar things can happen at Jindabyne as well for people walking the bank. You often send your mate up onto the hill to chase out the swarms of grasshoppers and then wait for the risers. You know, it can be really good. So I don't know. I mean, the rainbows really do rely on that stocking, but if they can't get enough wild fish to strip to stock, that's not good either.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I would expect it's probably going to take at least a couple of seasons for the rainbow stocks to start recovering. But in the meantime, what we might see is some really great condition large browns coming from some of these waterways, probably in lower numbers. But hopefully the quality might make up a little bit for some of the lack of numbers.
Well, we know that they can grow pretty big every year around the portal. Someone catches a monster. I was just reading about a fellow in the Twizel Canals who caught a 44-pound, 5-ounce Salmo Trutta, the brown trout. So, you know, they're just dependent on how much food they get to eat, aren't they?
Absolutely. And look, there are some enormous browns in Yukambeen. I had one a couple of years ago in a competition that I couldn't get to fit in my boat net. I literally couldn't lift it into the boat. It was half hanging out of my net, and when I tried to lift it in, it flipped out.
And you lost it.
And I lost it, yeah.
This is a recurring theme with you, Peachy. There's a great video you posted from a beautiful secret Victorian stream. We won't give away your spots, where you were Euro nymphing and hooked into a really big fish. It was, I don't know if it was double figures, but it was certainly getting up there. It was certainly getting up there for a stream fish, and you fought it and fought it and fought it. What happened?
Well, yes, I the last pull of the day, and it looked fantastic through this gorge section of the river. I came up tight on a fish, and it jumped, and I think the first thing I said was, "Oh, that's a big fish." But I think what happened when the fish first jumped and it landed is it wrapped itself in my leader. And I was fishing pretty light tippet, about 6x tippet, which in sort of breaking strain terms is about 2.5 or 3 pounds. It's pretty light. Anyway, this was obviously a much larger fish than that. And I had to be pretty careful because it was a gorge section of a river that I wasn't going to be able to follow the fish downstream if it decided to go downstream. So I had to go fairly light on it and just try to coax it back up into the eddy where I was standing. And after a few minutes, I started getting it back towards me in the eddy, and I realized it was coming in sort of sideways or tail first. And I thought, oh no, this is not good. Anyway, I fought it away for around about 15 minutes, almost had it to the net 2 or 3 times. And then at the end of it, as I was getting it back towards the net, again, the hook pulled. And I actually got my fly back. I didn't break the tippet. I was just left holding my fly, thinking, oh, what if? You know, anyway, I think that fish has grown by about 2 pounds a month ever since in my memory.
Well, not far from there at all. Not far from there at all. The story of the capture of the biggest brown trout that we've ever had on The Big Fish. We spoke to Cale Brown, who lives at Cancoban, and did a great job. This is back in 2018, March 2018. And this fish doubled the population of Cancoban with fly fishers. First cast, he went down to a pondage where the pipes come down the mountain, where this huge brown trout had taken up residence and was just eating all the little fish that were being chopped up. It was like getting a constant high-protein, high-fat diet, sitting there and just chewing away. He had a twiggy little 5-weight fly rod and a 6-pound leader, and he dropped a little fly on its nose. He saw it, and then he went back and caught it. He fought it for over an hour and weighed it and had it stuffed and mounted and had the evidence to prove it. And that was the biggest one we've heard of it on this program. Anyway, and that was from pretty close to where you lost your monster. But that was one of the great stories on The Big Fish. And it was in this sort of pondage. It couldn't sort of go anywhere. There are a lot of those sorts of fish, the browns particularly, who they'll in the Derwent, for example, up where those dams run in, you know, there are fish over 20 pound there that are caught quite regularly. So we do have the monsters. We do have the monsters, the portal as well at Eucanbeen. They'll hook into some submarines there as well. So you never know, do you, Peachy, when that monster's going to come along.
That's right. They are there, and if you fish long enough and well enough, you'll definitely cross paths with them.
I think the biggest one I hooked, and it had to be well over 10 pound, I'm sure, it was on the Tumut River late in the season. It was right down. I saw it jump. I thought, that's a monster. So I went up and I fished and I fished and I fished where it had been sitting near a log in the middle of the run. No good. So I gave up, went to the head of the run, last cast right at the very top. Just at the eye of the pool, and I should have realised that that's where the good fish lie. I hooked it and jumped right up and as high as my head, and I looked at it and I saw the little tiny nymph was just hanging from a slither on its cheek. And as soon as it hit the water, that fish was gone, but it was a monster. I reckon well over 10. I would even say 14. But it was a long time ago.
Yeah, there are some truly big fish. I saw one caught at in the Eucanbeen River, just above the dam there. That the guy who netted it was a member of the Australian team, a guy called Stuart Dick, and Stewie had worked in trout farms in aquaculture, and he estimated it was a rainbow that my friend caught, and he estimated it at 15 pounds.
Wow. I think that's the one they've got outside the pub at Adamitaby, isn't it? It's on a pedestal.
Yeah.
It's The Big Fish with Steve Peachy Peach, fly fishing guru and addict. Now, the New England Tablelands are central west, of course. We don't have to go all the way down to the Snowies to fish. What have you heard from the central west first up?
Well, the central west, there's a few fish around in the usual sort of catchments. I haven't heard any massive numbers of fish, but I've certainly heard people coming across, you know, a few. Again, they seem to be primarily browns that I'm hearing about rather than rainbows. You know, so as always with the Central West, I would say if you're going to get out there and fish it, it's better to get out there now, get out there early season or late season, because a lot of those rivers tend to get too warm in the middle of summer. So I always think of the Central West as a shoulder season fishery.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it doesn't have the same altitude as the Snowies, for example, or the Northern Tablelands, for that matter.
Yeah, very, very good early season. I guess some of the rivers get a bit of thermal pollution, as they say, a bit of cold water coming out of the bottom of the dam at Oberon and whatnot, the rivers like the Fish, and they tend to stay. The fish are quite resilient out there, though. I don't hear of much stocking. They seem to be wild fish, most of them.
Oh, no, there is a reasonable amount of stocking. There's a fellow called Ray Tang from the Wallerang CAS, which is the Acclimatisation Society, and they're pretty active in stocking a lot of the the rivers in that area.
Tell you where Ray has been putting them, and Ray and I have done a fair bit of fishing together over the years. He's been putting them into the Portland pond.
Yes.
the ones that they've relocated to give the Macquarie perch a chance, and there are some big, beautiful big browns in that particular waterway. Yeah. If you want to cast a few flies, have you given it a go?
I haven't fished the mill pond, no, but certainly when I get out that way to fish dams, I tend to go to Thompson's Creek Dam just because it's such a great site.
Oh, it's amazing. Have you heard anything from Tomo's? Any word on the numbers? Because that does rely on stocking,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. Look, my mate Jared was out there the other day, and I think he said he caught 20-something fish in a couple of hours, and we were all gobsmacked by this, and then we discovered from one of the other club members that it had just been stocked at that point, either that day or the day before. So
yeah,
it was a bit of an anomaly, I think.
They grow to immense proportions there, don't they? They really do, and
yeah.
It's through the goodwill of the people who own that waterway that anglers are allowed, so we've got to be very careful. It's artificials only, isn't it? You're not allowed to stay there after dark.
That's right. And you know, the other thing there, of course, now is these days we're not allowed to fish off the dam wall, which we used to be able to do, but for liability purposes the owners have stopped that. But that can be a little frustrating when you're walking along the top of the dam wall and you peer down in the water and see enormous fish cruising along the dam wall.
Look at those damn fish. But it's a great winter fishery. I've fished there in snowstorms.
Yep.
Froze my dear old dad to death. We wrote a story about it for Fly Life. But I got a lovely big rainbow on a sinking line. That was really exciting. But it was harsh. You know, it is an amazing fishery. It's quite deep, so I would assume there'd be a bit of water in there.
Yeah. And look, it seems to, for whatever reason, it always seems to stay pretty clear. Which is nice, even when some of the other waterways in the area have really dirtied up because of a lot of rain. Tomo's is usually fishable, at least in terms of water clarity, which is nice.
Yeah, it's a great place. It can be a bleak place, particularly in winter when it does fire. Well, what about safety of vehicles parked at the wall? That had been a problem in the past. Have you heard any issue with that, or is it resolved?
No, I haven't heard anything about that recently. I mean, there is a bit of a walk, obviously. You can't park right at the wall now. You do have to park at the end of the road and walk through the turnstile. And it's about, perhaps a K and a half up to the dam. But I haven't encountered any issues with that, no.
That's good to hear. Maybe it was a one-off for an unlucky fly fisher. Steve, thanks for giving us that overview. I hear the New England's going very, very well. I've got a few spies up in that part of the world, and there's plenty of water in the rivers, and hopefully the cormorants haven't hoovered all the fish out, but it gets lots of stocking up there from the hatchery at Ebor on the Sticks, and tends to go well early season as well. We might be in for a drier summer, so that could mean get into them now. Hey, tight line, Steve. Thanks for talking to us on The Big Fish again.
Good on you, Scott. Thanks.
Steve Peachy Peach. He's got a great YouTube channel for free as well if you want to subscribe and have a look at some of his adventures. And he's a great exponent of the Euro nymphing as well, which is a very good technique for some of the faster, deeper water on our rivers.
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Yeah.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
You've been lobbying, and I'm not talking about lobbying to stop the pippies from being taken from the beaches. You've been lobstering, I believe, or you've just hung up your traps. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the lobster season here in Port Stephens runs from about the end of June up until the end of October. That's June, July. No, the end of July. It's the end of July till the end of October, and that sees the season out. But commercial fishermen here, they catch beautiful, beautiful lobsters here from Broughton Island, well, from Seal Rocks to Barubi in the south, that's Anna Bay. There's just wonderful lobster habitat. And so they'll, that's when they work flat out, and they'd probably have maybe 50 traps out between here and halfway to Anna Bay. So there's a lot of traps out, but they're in a quota system, so they can't catch more than the quota allows them. But this season hasn't been as good as previous seasons. But for a recreational like I am, if you just get a few, well, you know, you're in front, really.
This is a sort of self-imposed closed season. You just give it up because it's not as good. But there's no actual closed season on them, is there?
No. It's just the season when you're most likely to catch one.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, every sea creature comes and goes. They don't stay all year round. But that's the season for lobsters here. It might be different elsewhere, but that's what it is here.
And the fisheries are saying that there's been a recovery allowing for sustainable fishing. They up the recreational take to 3 lobsters per person per day. So they must have some evidence to suggest that they're sustainable, making comeback.
Yeah, well, fisheries, when it's done, there's an increase in the bag limit, you know that what fisheries doing, they're on the right track. Because they're very hesitant, and so they should be, as in increasing bag limit. But it's generally go the other way. We generally decrease the bag limit. But with the lobsters, as you say, it has increased from 2 to a daily catch of 3. And that's because of good management. I mean, I know all the commercial fishermen here, and they work the area pretty good, hard, but they use salted bait, so they only check their traps once a week or sometimes even longer than that, whereas a recreational who puts fresh bait in there probably checks their trap once every 2 days. So it all works out at the end of the season, and this season's over, pretty much over, and everyone will wait until July next year for the start of the season. But really, if you're lucky or you know where to go, you can sort of catch a few most of the time through the year. It's just that period I've indicated is the best period.
And you don't get too many trap robbers, ratters?
Oh, you do. That's always a problem. Yep, theft. And up in the harbour for crab traps too. Theft's been going on for forever. It seems to be part of the game. They'll lift the trap, and divers are the worst problem. Skin divers are the worst problem, especially if your trap's in shallow water. But, that's part of the game, really. It just very few get caught, unfortunately.
Yeah, as in thieves.
That's right. But the worst problem you can possibly come across if you're trapping See, in my younger days, I would be diving, and you grab them with a glove. You can grab a lobster, and you can take two those years. But now I trap them, and it's a much easier. You don't have to jump in the water. But the worst problem is if you get a wobbegong in your trap. Now, they defy physics, wobbegong sharks, because they've got a head that's 2 feet wide and the trap is only 1 foot. The hole's only 1 foot wide. But the wobbegong pushes and pushes and screws his head, twists and turns until he gets inside the trap, and then he takes up the whole trap, and he's longer than the trap. The wobbegong's longer, and he destroys the trap, and then you try and pull it up, which makes it it's a real grind to try and get it to the surface. And when you get it to the surface, there's this big wobbegong smiling at you, saying, "Oh, I'm sorry, but I'm stuck in here. Can you get me out?" Well, there's another problem, trying to get him out. Oh, dear. The things that wear me down.
Yeah. You ever caught anything like anything edible, like a snapper or any decent fish?
Oh, my word. After a bit of a sea, you'll get good snapper, sometimes 2 kilo. I've never got anything bigger than 2 kilo, but it's quite a common occurrence for snapper to go into lobster traps.
Ah, very, very interesting indeed. What about red rock cod? They don't go in, do they?
Yeah, they go in there too, red rock cod. Yeah, they'll poke their nose in. Yeah.
Have you been hit by one, Stinker? Have you ever been?
A long time ago, I got a little prick by one, which was and I never really got the full impact of it, but I got enough of it to know, and I'm not going close to that thing again, because it'll make you jump.
Very close to the venom of the stonefish, not as potent, but similar in a lot of ways, and people who've been hit by them that I've spoken to said it was the most excruciating pain they've ever had and ended up in hospital. They're pretty nasty.
Well, I knew a bloke, this is going back quite a while now, and out on the rocks in front of the lighthouse, he swum over there, and then he got spiked over there quite badly, and he was history, there's nothing he could do. He was in, extreme pain. He couldn't walk or swim, so they had to get a helicopter and get him off the rock. Oh, that was ages ago. But they're pretty nasty characters, those red rock cod.
They are indeed. I love that story you told, the bloke who was really wealthy, who hired the biggest game boat in Port Stephens. It was about 40 foot long, to go and bottom bounce for red rock cod, which many see as rubbish fish.
That's right. I think the man had Greek heritage, and he was a hairdresser in Sydney. This is a while back. And he'd come here with this great thumping boat. Oh, gee, it was a beautiful thing. When you put stink pot beside it, it looked like, you know, my boat was like a tender for this one.
Yeah.
Anyway, he contacted me because he heard me on the radio. And he said, "Oh, look, could you come with me?" And I said, "Oh, no, I don't normally don't, because, you know, I just sort of pretty much keep to myself." Anyway, he said, "Oh, no," he said, "you're going to bring all the kids and you're going to have a real nice time." And I thought, "Oh, that's fair." So I had all these kids, and I said, "Would you all like to go out in a big boat?" Yeah, that'd be great. So I said, "Okay." I said, "What do you want to catch? You want to catch snapper or kingfish, or, you know, what do you want to catch?" And he said, "Do you know where any red rock cod?" I said, "Unfortunately, I do." I said, "I know where all the red rock cod are." And he said, "Well, that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to catch as many red rock cod as we possibly can." So I went and got some pippies and hand lines, and I've got all these kids. There were three kids on one side and I think one kid on the other side of the boat. And they lowered down their hand lines. We were only in 30 foot of water. And they were pulling up all sorts of strange-looking creatures. But occasionally we'd get a red rock cod. I think we ended up with, oh, I don't know, we must have got 15, I say, Red Rock got varying sizes from little ones up to big ones. But every time a Red Rock God come over the side of the boat, this man who owns a boat, $1 million boat, he was doing tap dance and, oh, he's the greatest thing on earth, catching these Red Rockies.
And if you're fishing for a snapper and one of those big flower pots comes up with a big gaping mouth, you go, oh, there goes another good bait. But I was just looking them up, actually. The Eastern Red Rock Cod is actually a scorpion fish, a very close relative of the stonefish, Scorpionus cardinalis. So that's why they're very lethal. They're very, very, very dangerous. So be very careful handling them. We're speaking with Stinker. It's the big fish. And Stinker, I believe that you might be joining the soft plastic brigade. It's taken you a while to get on board, mate.
I'm going to the dark side, Scott. Going to the dark side. Like, I've avoided plastics as long as I can. Plastics have sort of emerged from the murky days when Mr. Twisters hit the scene. This is going back, I don't know, I wonder how long ago it was that when Mr. Twisters come on the market.
It had to be the 70s, I reckon it'd be the 70s, that long ago.
I'm not sure. That'd be interesting to find out. But I remember when Mr. Twister come on the market, and of course there's that wobbly jelly stuff, and everyone said, well, this is the greatest trick that's been ever pulled on us. It's obviously an American idea, and they're out to just get money off us for no return. Well, then a few people started catching fish with this Mr. Twister, and then we went, the whole walls of bait and tackle shops now are devoted to plastic. Well, it must work. I mean, you don't fill so many lures unless they actually work. Well, of course, they do work, and there's no great trick to it. I mean, you throw them in the right place, pretty much. That's about the aim of the game. And there's plenty of right places here around in front of my house. Unbelievable. And you know what? A lot of places are never, ever, ever fished. No one's ever fished them. They always talk about wilderness and places where people haven't been. Well, there are so many options here to fish for snapper, and I've been keeping my eye on the place for 50 years, and there's a lot of places that are real, look, perfect snapper habitat that I've never ever seen anyone fish. And you can only go fishing at one spot at a time, so I haven't been able to go to all these places, but there's got to be there. They've just got to be there, especially after a bit of sea. But anyway, I've always told you, Scott, and all the listeners, that I wait for the 2 metre sea and a southerly wind. Well, that's not happening often enough. And so I've run out of fish. So I've got to go and fish. I can catch littler ones in a nor'easter. I go to the apple tree, which is just on the edge of a sanctuary zone, and I can catch them there every time I go. But you rarely get a fish over a kilo and a half. But if you want the bigger ones, you've got to get out into the tiger country in front of the lighthouse, and now I'm going to sneak out there with plastics. Heaven forbid.
I just did a bit of research. The first plastic that we can recall, the Mr. Twister lure, arrived in Australia in the early to mid-70s, and I do remember my Uncle Johnny, who was a great fisherman at Swansea, lived at Swansea, and he started using them on the flathead back then, and he swore by them, but they were weird things. It's funny how everything old is new again, too. You were talking to me about your the old-school flathead approach in Port Stephens, where you get a set of gangs and a pilchard and a little pea-sinker on the nose. A friend of mine, young Alex, who's just a young university student, loves his fishing. I said, where have you been, Alex? He said, I went up to Hawk's Nest and I fished and got six lovely flathead off the beach for dinner. And I said, what did you use? Soft plastics. He said, no, I use a pilchard on ganged hooks and a little pea sinker on its nose. So the kids are trying the old ways as well, Stinker.
It's the deadliest way, I reckon. You don't have to work it at all. All you do is you toss it out, let it sink, and then slowly, slowly retrieve it. It doesn't need to be lifted. All you do is retrieve it. And then you wait for a bump, a really significant bump. Now, that bump can be a rock on the bottom, but if you're on a sandy beach, it's highly unlikely there's going to be a rock there. But once you feel that bump, then you stop winding. But there's one problem to that way of doing things, and that is I always used to use frog mouth pilchards. Now, frog mouth pilchards with three 2-0s and a frog mouth pilchard with a pea sinker on the nose is deadly, deadly. But unfortunately, frog mouth pilchards are basically a thing of the past, as are big white pilchards. You could get big whites that would carry 3-2-0 hooks too. Now you can't do that. So it's a very sad thing in my opinion. I'd like to find out a bit more about where they went. But frog mouth pilchards and white pilchards are not around like they used to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to ask him what he was using. Maybe just the smaller ones that are the blue pilchards or the Western Australian pilchards probably. But he got five fish and let one go. And all on that method, just walking the beach at Hawk's Nest. So there you go.
That pilchard you're talking about, that smaller West Australian pilchard, he takes 3-3-0s. And that's good too. That's good. What you can also do is a strip of mullet or a strip of slimy mackerel. They work equally as well. And you put 3-2-0s in a strip of slimy mackerel. That's real good. That's good flathead bait too. And throw that out and slowly bring it back in the corner of the beach. Early in the morning on the top of the tide, and you'll get, and this is it. This is the start of it. October is the start of it. It's the start of the snapper. It's the start of the flathead. It's the start of the whiting. Everything is revving up. And then the mud crabs, they're starting to lumber through the mangroves. And the blue swimmers are tap dancing up and down all the channels. So this place is rocking. It's just getting ready for Christmas, really. It's a dynamic fishing spot. And the best part about it is you can spread out. You're not all sitting on top of each other because there's so much water.
There's a massive waterway, the Port Stephens area, and you've got the Myall Lakes and then all of the beaches to the north and the south. I mean, the beach between Port Stephens and Seal Rocks, it's a monster as well, isn't it? Then you've got Stockton, the longest beach in New South Wales. It extends all the way back down to the Port of Newcastle. We're speaking with Stinker on the Big Fish. And that method, using ganged hooks and small fish baits or cut bait or pilchards, do you sort of retrieve it the same way as a soft plastic, give it a lift up, or it's more of a slow roll?
No, just what I do, I throw it. See, most of the fish that you catch are within 5 metres of the beach. You don't throw it out. You throw it pretty much parallel to the beach. And then you can walk. You can walk with it at a slow pace, and then you can feel the bump. Or you can throw it just so that it lands about 2 metres off the beach and then slowly, slowly retrieve. So it's coming back along the beach around about 2 metres out. And that's where you'll find, early in the morning, top of the tide, that's where the big flathead are. And then, like I say, you get that bump and then all the hairs on the back of your neck stick up, you go, woohoo! And then I count to 30, in pretty slowly until I get to 30 or 40 sometimes. And then I don't strike like crazy. I just lean back. And 9 times out of 10, there he is sitting on it, just laying there, unbeknownst to the fact that I'm on the other end.
Ah, gotcha. Well, these are good techniques. Do you use the gangs that have the swivels between the hooks, or just straight eye to eye?
No, I just open up the eye of the hook and bang the other one through, and then open up the barb and then close the eye. The old method. But if you can get the straight hooks, like it's an O'Shaughnessy, I think, that hasn't got the curb in it, that you don't really need a curb, just a straight hook. 3-2-0s or 3-3-0s rely, or even 3-4-0s, but then your bait gets a little bit too big. It's in the flathead, they love it. But I do feel for the old frogmouth, the frogmouth pilchard. I dream about the frogmouth pilchard. It's just the most beautiful fish. And really, I've gone to big fishing shops, and there's the freezer, and there's none in there at all, which is very sad because They were in such huge numbers. When I was growing up on the far north coast, the sea would go black with frogmouth pilchards. And now that doesn't happen.
Well, maybe someone in fisheries or one of our listeners can answer Stinker's question as to what happened to the huge runs of frogmouth pilchards. Hey, mate, tight lines. It's always great to get those methods. And it's interesting when you explore, even though you say that's a simple method, if you were throwing straight out and not fishing parallel to the beach, you probably wouldn't catch any.
Well, you'd catch less because you're only your strike zone. See, it's all to do with strike zone and to where the fish is most likely to be. Now, they're not going to be 30 metres out because there's no reason for them to be there. They're going to be on the shoreline because that's where they feed. And that's where they're most likely to get a small crustacean or a potty mullet or a little whiting. That's where they catch them. So why throw away out? And there's a lesson to be learned here, especially over holiday period, in that the family go down to the beach. Dad, he got his new rod for Christmas, and he goes, whooshka. Well, he throws it. All the fish are watching this great thing hurtle out to sea. And then he sits on the beach and holds it. Where the kids have got those little El Cheapo rods, they will go and they can't throw out very far. Or mum's there too, and she struggles to throw the distance. But they're the ones that catch the fish because that's where the fish are, in nice and close. Not halfway to Africa where Dad's bait's gone.
That's so true. And don't you see the evidence of it at low tide when you walk along there and you see all those big arrowhead prints of those big flathead that have been sitting there in the sand right up against the bank, ambushing those fish, using that bank as the backstop. So you're spot on, Stinker. You're sharing some great wisdom. Hey, great to talk to you again on The Big Fish. Tight lines, mate.
Hooroo, Scott.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
I hope that's inspired you to get out and get into them. I know what I'm doing right now. Tight lines, have a great weekend. Hope you catch a few.
I'm tired of this rhythm and blues. I'm gonna grab me a pole and go down to the hole and kick off my blues weight shoes. I'm going fishing. I'm going fishing. So if you can't wait, just get you some bait and come go fishing with me. I love my boogie woogie. I love to play my jazz, but I need a break. I'm going down to the lake and get me a wide-mouth bass. I'm going fishing. I'm going fishing. So if you can't wait, just grab some bait and come go fishing with me. Johnny be good. You can shout out Tango Ray, but I'll be in my dreams. I'm going upstream. I'll be back in 30 days. I'm going fishing. Oh yes, I'm going fishing. Just grab your pole and meet me down at the hole and come go fishing with me. It's going fishing. I'm going fishing. Oh yes, going fishing. me down at the hole and just come fishing with me.
Get out of it, bloody seagulls.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.